you want copies? I would like to come in and read the Word of God. Now look, if you are on your way to heaven, and I am on the way to hell, what is this to you?
There's some wonderful people overnight. I think Matt Schmid is brilliant, and Arpo Martin is brilliant, but I don't know how many people get to hear them. And I want to say thanks. It's a tremendous job.
Well, thank you very much for that.
In the morning, early Monday morning, my vacation starts as soon as I get this show in the can. Yes, it's the dustbin of history for the Wednesday into Thursday while I am down in Baltimore with the Gotham Radio Players and supposedly on vacation. Time for Lost Gene Shepherd from the Gary Hines collection from this day in history, more or less. September 18th, 1963. Many things are featured in this program, closing with a story of the Esquire Club getting busted. Enough intro, let's hear it, shall we? Lost Gene Shepherd, available nowhere else but right here in the dustbin of history, WBAI New York.
much as I hate to make accusations, I have uncovered evidence that there is a cabal here at WOR which was responsible for breaking the G minor string on my balalaika. It looks as though I am going to have to sing of the glories and the pleasures of just being alive, sing of the earth, sing of vitality and the deep, rich mother lode of existence, a cappella. Yes, a cappella. I'll be loving you always. It doesn't work. It just doesn't work. I don't like to talk like this about Martha Dean, Al McCann, other small-minded people who have been masquerading as deep thinkers on this station these many years. Let me tell you this. There are those who believe in frozen asparagus, and then there are those of us who believe in life. Yes. To paraphrase my friend Jonas Mekas, the Village Voice, it's a time. Guy's got to stand up. Guy's got to sing. He's got to say it out loud. He's got to call it out to the heavens. It's a time. There's a little slice of me I've got to throw out to you. I'll be loving you always with... Oh, that's right, clown, laugh, laugh with the feckless emptiness of life. It doesn't work. I don't know what it is. I just can't get it going. This a cappella doesn't work as well as... Any of you know where I can get a set of balalaika strings? Oh, it's not even easy to play an a cappella nose flute. It's very hard sometimes, and I'm going to beg all of your forbearance out there. I know that you people are long-suffering. I know that you people, being 20th century men, are under the influence of forces that you don't quite comprehend. Great moving blocks of eternity grinding us to tiny iotas of living flotsam and jetsam tossed on the eternal, roaring, raging sea of time. I know this. I'm bobbing up and down here with you. I'm fully aware of that, and I by George, I'm pleased as punch that every night you take the time out to tune me in. So I bob up and down here, this great roaring, raging sea of time, and things that go along with it, you know, the things that can, you know. Sometimes it's just beyond all of us. I know that. I'm aware of that. I'm perfectly aware of that. I had a call from a little old lady who assured me that it was going to be all right. But then little old ladies have always been assuring me that it's going to be all right. I'll never forget a little old lady that assured me that it was going to be all right just before I left for Camp Crowder. I'll never forget that. She, young man, you're going off to do the finest thing you've ever done. Well, she's right. 17 straight days of KP. I haven't had a job since. Not that I could call a job, actually. So, I mean, sometimes... Yeah, how many of you know about the work of Nathaniel West? You know, I'm quite sure that most of Staten Island thinks I'm making drivel here. And a large portion of Long Island, and I'd say a considerable segment of New Jersey. You know, American life, I think, is the greatest, it's the greatest discovery, seriously, since the snap top beer can opener. American life is a kind of life that is, well, it's sort of foam rubber. We, in one way or another, because of the ease of our life, even the guy that works the hardest here has the toughest life, has a pretty easy life compared to the tough life of guys in other countries. This is true. And, so our whole scale of values and everything is all set in a different, wholly different frequency. It's like one, it's like the whole world is working on the 40 meter band and somehow America has somehow gotten on 75. And, you know, on single sideband. And everybody else is trying to make do with the rotary spark gaps. And having a little trouble with QRM. And somehow we've been able to work out. It's an interesting thing. And so, naturally, we have very little concept of what could be called the grotesque aspect of existence. And yet, on the other hand, other writers do. Have you ever seen Genet? Of course, you've seen The Blacks, and no doubt you've seen The Balcony. This is a European concept. No good American could write that. Not a bit of it. Have you ever seen Ionesco? Or somebody like Dürrenmatt? But even more than that, somebody like Beckett. Beckett. And these guys are dealing in a subject that is hardly ever touched in Teaneck. In fact, it's barely hinted at, although you do see hints of it. If you look at the current Life magazine, there's a great article on the funeral racket. And, yes. It's a fantastic article, and particularly about the salesman in the funeral racket. So you understand a little bit about what Genet is discussing. There's a salesman standing there with his hands clasped at thorax level. And he's got, that kind of dynamic ecclesiastical look that salesmen who are selling eternity get. And he is saying to his customers, of course, you'll want your loved one to be buried at heart level, above the ground. Heart level, we say in the industry, prayer level. Well, that means he's going to be shoved on a shelf in a brick wall. It's at prayer level. And so this scene, while a perfect scene right out of Ionesco, is not necessarily understood as such in Teaneck. Now, I think tonight, since we're dealing with that aspect of life, the Nathaniel West world, which is probably as close to the real world, I'd say he's much closer to the real world. Who is more of a surrealist, Nathaniel West, or say Norman Vincent Peale? Or Edgar Guest. Or Nick Kenny. Who's more of a surrealist there? Who's dealing more with in fantasy? Have you ever read West, The Day of the Locust, the last scene there? And, West particularly got very close to something very true, in his, Miss Lonely Hearts. And only a person who works in one of the big mass media would know that. Oh boy. Let me tell you, only a person who works, let's say, in a radio station at 710 on the dial would know how close he came to Realitiesville. And I'm sure, I remember one night outside of a theater, I was very curious. I went to see one of the European plays, and I believe it was Genet. I don't recall which one. I think it was The Balcony, as a matter of fact. And I came out, and we were milling around there, a lot of people, and everybody's sort of heading for cabs and things and waiting to get out of there. And I'm standing next to a lady who must have been well in her 70s, and she's with a distinguished gentleman with a Homburg hat, and they had come from that uptown. You know, they were strictly the Mary Martin, Howard Teichman, Brooks Atkinson world, and they'd heard that this was a big thing, because they go to all the big things. And I was curious about it, what she was thinking of this. And I asked her in a casual, what'd you think of it? We're all standing together. That's one thing about the village. Everybody's sort of standing together down there, even, you know, heavy-set ladies and skinny guys and everything. You can get away with it. So I said, what'd you think of it? And her answer, I think, epitomizes pretty much what most people think when they see that side of life. Oh, of course, it's just a story. Just a story. Well, I didn't know how to feel that one, you see, since I didn't bring my mitt. And so I tried to knock it down with my bare hand, and it stung, I'll tell you. I got a jammed thumb that went. I was out of the game for over 4 weeks after that one. Well, it was just a story. Speaking of jammed thumbs, this is WOR AM with FM New Yorkie here. And we have with us, Peter, Paul, and Mary. Peter, Lynn Hayes, and Mary Healy are coming to friendly old WOR Radio Land starting Monday, September the 30th. It's delightful best there every weekday morning at 9:15. How do they ever describe me when they do promos on me? Am I called, am I delightful best every night at 11:15? They don't have promos for me. WOR has a mental block on me. It's like I prefer to think that I'm not here. You know? I'm actually over at one of those other things. Oh, speaking of, you wouldn't believe it, I've got a commercial here, and a delightful one, as a matter of fact. I wonder how many of you have been sticking around this corner here ever since I had, as one of the great sponsors of the past, Volvo, the Volvo automobile. Well, they're back on the show, and among other things that I have done in my checkered career, I have been an automobile dealer of foreign cars. And I want to tell you, as a dealer, as an ex-dealer, I should say, boy, did I get taken. Whew. Boy, they took my shirts, my socks, and everything else. But I'll tell you, I learned a lot on the way. And one of the things I learned was that probably the best import made for the American road, dollar for dollar and pound for pound, and I am not kidding you, is the Volvo, particularly the 544. I particularly enjoy driving that car. One of the greatest evenings of driving through a fantastic snowstorm here in New York City that I've ever experienced was in a Volvo. And if you have never driven a Volvo, I would suggest by all means, if you're thinking of buying a car this fall, see your Volvo dealer. And by the way, the Volvo really holds its trade-in value. It's a very, very handy thing to have around on the used car market. And I would suggest you see it if you are planning a new car. This is a good machine. The Volvo, Swedish, excellent workmanship all the way through. And one of the places where it's for sale is the Beckrag Auto Sales Corp, 43 Harrison, East Orange. Okay? Now, getting back to the Nathaniel West world, there's a story I want to tell you. I think I once told this story on the air, and I don't know whether I should tell it or not again, because it was a story that caused a little uproar, because it is literally a description of the way life can often be, and is often, and more often than not is, a matter of actual record. I think the first, to get you in the mood, to let you know that Nathaniel West was not inventing what he talked about reality and about the way people are in the world. You know, it's impossible, really, for a short story writer to create out of his imagination, I don't care how wildly he works in science fiction or in horror fiction, whatever it might be, it is impossible for a short story writer to actually create a world as replete in horror as that which actually occurs. This is true. And that's for that reason, most guys prefer to work in the world of romance. They prefer to work in the world of great conflict and strife. They stay away from horror. Because horror has, in our world, in our life, it is the one part of life that we all turn our back on. We instinctively turn our back on. And the more we see of it, the more we know that it's there, and the more we pretend often that it doesn't exist at all. Did you hear? Now, how could a short story writer create this? Do you have my gothic music in there for me, Eddie? Yes.
Los Angeles Associated Press. An Oregon man was run over and killed Tuesday night when he tried to keep a motorist from crashing into a busload of persons returning from a Jehovah's Witnesses meeting, police said. Officers arrested George Albert Rivera, 38, and booked him on suspicion of murder after Harold Mather, 38, of Roseburg, Oregon, died at General Hospital. Police gave this account. A chartered bus from Coos Bay, Oregon, was returning 38 Jehovah Witnesses to their hotel after a meeting of the International Convention of Jehovah's Witnesses. Rivera pulled in front of the bus and forced the driver, Marvin Skelf, 33, of Coos Bay, to stop. Skelf and Mather got off the bus to investigate. Rivera turned his car around and headed for the bus. As Skelf tried to grab the ignition keys, Rivera shook him loose and then headed the car for Mather. Mather, whose wife and 9-year-old daughter were on the bus, was knocked down and dragged 100 feet before Rivera's car ran over him and killed him instantly, police said. Rivera was questioned later by police, who noticed his damaged car, then was arrested. Officers said Rivera told him that he hated buses. I have orders from above to stop them and make them stay in their yard. Buses are smog violators. I had orders from above to stop them at all costs, even if I had to kill them, he said. That night, the Jehovah Witnesses had their prayer meeting as usual and did not mention the incident. Well now, that's just a newspaper story, Clarence. I wouldn't pay a bit of attention to it. Now, let us take another dip into the reality of the now. This one is from the New York Post, September, Wednesday, 18-1963. San Francisco, September 18th, Associated Press. Police disclosed today that an argument over four poodles apparently resulted in two murders. The accidental death of a woman and the slaying of the dogs at Vacaville, a suburb of San Francisco. Officers said Mrs. George R. Montano, 38, shot her second husband, Air Force Sergeant Pedro Montano, 35, following a quarrel over the dogs. Then, police said, her former husband, Harry H. White, 45, who married her in her native Belgium, either came to the house by chance or was called over by Mrs. Montano. She shot White, according to the police, suffocated the dogs by placing plastic bags over their heads, and then spread a volatile liquid throughout the home, intending to set it fire to cover up her crime. There was an explosion, and Mrs. Montano was killed. Police said she apparently killed the dogs to make it appear that they had died in the fire with her husband and former husband. And so, friends, the four poodles were buried yesterday at a pet cemetery near a 2,200-pound red granite tombstone reaching to the skies, which bore the following inscription: To my poodles, they were loving, faithful, and beautiful, the best friends a woman can ever have, Georgia R. White. By the way, Mrs. White was a contestant once on Queen for a Day. Now, she was, as a matter of fact. Now, the strange kinds of horror that are at the part of... Now, horror doesn't necessarily come in that form. There are all kinds of horror. There's the horror of the murder. There's the horror of the insane attack on a bus with God's help. There are all kinds of horrors. One of my favorite, you have my American music there all set in there, Eddie? One of my favorite kinds of horror. Yeah, that's what I have. All together now. You'll like this one, friend. That's not quite yet. But it'll do. Yeah, now this is the kind of horror that would have particularly been appreciated by Nathaniel West. from the Daily Home News, New Brunswick, New Jersey, Friday, September 13th, 1963, New York Associated Press. I want you to picture the scene, friends. Picture two housewives talking on the telephone. Suddenly one says, before we start talking about Mabel, let me bring you a message from... With this, she launches a 60-second spiel on the virtues of a certain toothpaste or a new dynamic deodorant. She is one of a new breed of housewife huckster. George Levine, a New York advertising man, is paying her to help him put word-of-mouth advertising on a business-like basis. The way George Levine puts it, this is the last great unexploited medium, says Levine, who heads an organization known as Inform Associates. This last great medium, which has not been exploited, is just waiting to be, as we say in the industry, tapped. He says, 8 test promotions in the last 2 months indicate the system is indeed potent. And he claims nobody seems to get mad at his network of secret housewives who talk up anything for a price. For delivering 100 one-minute commercials, Levine says, the housewife gets $3 in cash or trading stamps. For the service, the advertiser would pay Levine about $6 per 100 messages. We have no record of anybody getting sore when he discovers his friends are throwing commercials, said Levine. Actually, everybody seems to have, well, as we say, a hell of a lot of fun with it, actually. Nobody actually gets sore. The usual procedure, said Levine, is to give the housewives, quote, as he calls them, informants. A 100-word statement on the product or promotion. They memorize the key points and frame it in their own words, agreeing to deliver 100 one-minute commercials to friends. In most cases, how they do it is their own business. And how subtly they do it is also their own business. Some women like to deliver it just like a television commercial. You know, they've been watching Betty Furness for years, so many of them will stand next to their refrigerator and open the door and say, friends, I'd like you to notice the freezing compartment in my new Electrolux. You'll also notice that the wonderful frozen food department here has extra space and room. They've been watching Betty Furness. However, others just like to say simply, say, would you pass the sugar, Mabel? Oh, by the way, I noticed you're using Jack Frost. You know, that sugar melts so much easier in my coffee. And I've noticed, incidentally, I wonder if any of you have tried the new dry, easy snapback open and shut napkins. They're wonderful. I blow my nose. And I was talking to Charlie the other day by George. Incidentally, they... Well, he says, actually, they like to talk about the key points. Of course, we insist that they bring up all the key points. To keep score of the commercials they deliver in casual conversations with their friends, recruits, or, as Mr. Levine calls them, informants, are supplied with pocket-sized meters. Every time they give a commercial, they quietly and secretly trip a little meter with their thumb, thereby registering another score. And finally then, back at the home office, they sign affidavits that they actually delivered the messages.
We actually try to get honest people, says Levine.
Levine, a 39-year-old former school teacher, has 35 housewives. I repeat, he calls them informants in New York City, Boston, Baltimore, and Worcester, Mass. He hopes to recruit additional informants in Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, New Orleans, Cleveland, Toronto, Phoenix, Albuquerque, El Paso, Baltimore, Philadelphia, Montreal, Vancouver, London, Paris, Amsterdam. So,
You know, it's a funny thing. I'll tell you that you can see how effective that would work. That just would be, that's dynamite. That one's dynamite. Wait till the politicians get a hold of that one. And I can think of all kinds. I suppose though, eventually there will be some kind of a governing body. I guess people have to keep logs and things like that. Do you think they'll have to start licensing people like they license radio stations? And the guy will have to, for every 4 commercials he delivers, he has to give 1 public service spot? You know, public service spot. You know, the kind that says, oh, St. Charlie, I wonder if you, I notice you're out of work. Have you ever thought of the Marines for a career? They offer you a wonderful way for education, travel, and pay with a very good future and certainly security. And at the end of 20 years, you can retire. And now back to our regular program. Charlie, I'd like to tell you a little thing that I discovered the other day, just sitting around the house with Mabel, and I had been drinking Brand X beer. Well, that day, just by coincidence, a bottle of Rheingold got in the house. You know, I've been hearing those commercials for years, little realizing that actually... I wonder if people now are beginning to look upon their regular, casual, non-sponsored conversation as commercial time that is not selling. I wonder how they audition people. I wonder if they hire dull people. I'm sure that you have to come in and give a little sample of your life, a little sample of your style before they put you on. I mean, you can't have a clod delivering your Schlitz beer commercials. I mean, crying out loud, that can hurt the product all the way down the line, you know. Now, see, this is a kind of terror which is not often described as horror. It isn't described as horror by many people. They sort of a laugh about that and let it go at that. But this is an intriguing kind of horror, and it's the kind of horror that George Orwell foretold in 1984. He predicted, of course, because that's been done by many writers, but one of the things he predicted was that all people would work against one another, and using the lead sheep technique, that all people would learn in eventually that they can prey off other people and other people can prey off them. And if you can organize that feeling, you'd have a just an unbelievably potent force. You know, this is true in most dictatorial countries, in most monolithic societies, that to maintain a monolithic society, you must maintain a world of universal suspicion, where you never know whether the guy next to you is honest or not. And one of the best ways that a monolithic society, or any society for that matter, that wants to get information or get leads as to who the real soreheads are in the society, is to plant a lot of phony soreheads in that society. They'll plant a phony sorehead who'll jump up out of the crowd and holler, "Down with Stalin!" Well, of course, immediately all the "Down with Stalin" guys start drifting over in his department. And one of them says, "Oh, I hear you say down with Stalin. Well, brother, we will work together to..." Well, the next thing you know... Well, Orwell talked about this little scene, and now, of course, I don't quite know what people are going to do when they find their friends delivering commercials. Now, there are a lot of ways you can deal with a commercial in life. As you know, most people just automatically shut their ears. There's a certain automatic shuttering thing. It just closes up your mind when the thing comes out. You know, they're throwing the napkins around and the little white tornado shows up. All that stuff, you know, you just sort of, your mind just sort of starts to buzz a little bit and you just sort of drift off in the direction of ham sandwiches and the John and stuff. Well, I don't know how that'll work when Aunt Mabel comes over and starts belting them out. When Aunt Mabel starts telling you about Dutch cleanser. Now, how can you say, to Aunt Mabel, you know, you can't say, "Oh, come on, Aunt Mabel, cut the commercials." Well, Aunt Mabel's love will be very hurt because she is not on the payroll and is just giving you an authentic opinion. You see, that's where the real danger comes, and that's what Orwell was talking about. How universal suspicion finally creates truly universal suspicion. Nothing is believed anymore. Nothing whatsoever is believed. Absolutely nothing. And so I'm sure that this kind of kind of horror, which is an interesting kind of horror, and one that I'm sure never was foretold. Because I've never been frightened by things like Dracula. Have you, Eddie? Has Dracula that kind of jazz? Nah, I mean, it's always kind of funny. You see those guys with the cape swinging from the chandeliers, you know? you never see that in Cleveland. I mean, I never, we didn't have many vampires working around Hessville. And even a couple of moments there, I found myself a little gassed by Frankenstein's monster, but only because he reminded me of Mr. Bruner on Saturday Night. And he'd got that funny leaden look in his face just as he's about to wallop Junior with a ball bat. And that was a little fear there, but it was not really fear of the monster. It was a fear of retribution in the neighborhood. So that kind of stuff doesn't get me. The monster pictures. But the monster picture that shows a bunch of ladies delivering commercials one to the other. Now that monster picture could make goosebumps come up all up and down, you know, in the back of my ears and everything. Because then I keep thinking of all the things that friends of mine have said. Come to think of it, not more than a half an hour ago, not more than 20 minutes ago, I'm sitting in my office and this guy comes in and he hands me a candy bar. A friend of mine, what is, not more, now all of a sudden it's coming clear. Why? I mean, this guy never gave me any. Say, I want you to try a piece of this candy bar. It's a gas. I put a nickel in this machine, and this thing came out. It's got nuts on it. It's got the most creamy, wonderful, soft, juicy goodness. It has a taste that sticks right with you, and a taste that you can't forget. Well, I ate down 19 million calories, and I agree with him. Oh, for crying out loud, now that I think about it. Well, now, you never know. You just never know where they are. Now I don't know whether or not I should tell you this horror story. I think I will tell you this horror story. I told it to you once before. Well, I will tell it to you again for those of you who missed it and who think that Janae is inventing something. Well, ever since this story, I think I literally believe everything that Janae has written. Because I've seen it in my life. I literally believe, literally, and I'm not saying metaphorically. I believe, as true fact, the descriptions of life by Ionesco. Have any of you ever driven through the Black Forest at 2 o'clock in the morning with the temperature standing at say, 10 degrees above zero, and the little houses looking out of the darkness at you with the yellow lights winking? Well, you understand why Dürrenmatt writes the way he does. Can you imagine how a man who has lived, let's say, within 150 miles from a concentration camp where they had great gas ovens going day and night and the glow could be seen in the sky, how could he write The Sound of Music with a straight face? Or Oklahoma? Or Mary Mary with a straight face? Well, let me tell you what happened to me one time. I must have been about, well, I'll tell you exactly how old I was. I was a freshman in high school, so I was about 13, somewhere in that, 13, 14, something like that. And I lived in a residential area that was a sort of half country, half city area. You know that kind of place? It had vacant lots, and way down at the end of the street was a place called the Swamp. And the Swamp went all the way from Hammond to Gary. In those days, it was a giant swamp, and in that swamp were mud turtles and big mud hens, and there were frogs, millions of frogs, and you could hear the frogs. Just the sound of the frogs would just drift through the air like a great blanket of frog sounds at night, every night, and especially in the fall, right at this time of the year. You know, the frogs are even louder than they are in the springtime. I don't know what it is. The frogs get nervous with winter coming on. But it was just about the time that school was getting underway. And that great big swamp lay out there between the edges of Hammond and the beginnings of Gary. It had been many, many eons ago. It had been covered by water from Lake Michigan. And so the ground was all sandy, and there were shells. We could find shells in our backyard all the time. And pieces of driftwood and things from countless ages back when this was under 40 feet of Lake Michigan water. And the town had little vacant lots, and it was a pretty town. It still is, as a matter of fact. the part of town that I lived in, with little bungalows and little garages and little driveways and little terraced lawns and big trees that hung down over the streets and wide concrete runways and asphalt driveways up into long winding lawns, that kind of thing. And just on the other side was the swamp. And there were three or four schools in town. There was a couple of junior high schools, and there was a high school, four-year high school, and maybe four or five grade schools. And these were the kind of schools, you know, that had the red brick front, and they had white brick sills and shiny glass. And in the back, they had the football field and the track field and all that. Well, all of us went to school in one school or another. There was the Warren G. Harding School, and there was the Morton School, and there was the Hammond High School, and there was George Rogers Clark School, all good, solid American names. There was the Roosevelt High School. Now, how about that for an American name? They were all around there. Well, we grew in this neighborhood, all of us kids. And some kids were a little older, and some kids were a little younger. Just all of us growing up into life. I was about 13 or 14. I had just outgrown all the little kids, and I was not quite part of a crowd of big kids. And there were two or three guys I hung around with, Flick and Schwartz and kids like that. There were no gangs in the neighborhood at all. No gangs at all. There were just groups of kids that were roughly divided by age, that kind of thing. 16-year-old kids don't fool around with the 13-year-old kids. And the 13-year-old kids have forgotten about the 10-year-old kids. And they just sort of drift back and forth. There were a few girls in the neighborhood. And it was a very quiet, non-fist-fighting world there. Baseball on Saturday afternoon, baseball all day long, basketball in the backyards, that sort of thing. Well, along about September, a group of the kids who were probably 16 at the time, 16 and 17, I would say they were juniors and seniors and a few sophomores in high school around that neighborhood, formed a little club called the Esquire Club. Now, it was just a little kind of a club. It was not a gang, not at all. They would meet in guys' basements and pass rules, you know, that kind of thing, and sit around and drink Cokes and eat sandwiches and play pinochle. And the mother would come down with some graham crackers and some milk, and the Esquire Club would be meeting in this guy's basement, or they would be meeting the next week in another guy's basement, and they would play pinochle again and holler. Well, I knew about the club, and that was about all. It was one of the things that the bigger kids were involved in. Well, one day, I'd say roughly about November, in the cold, blue, beginning winter afternoon of that soft, easy Midwestern town, a man going to work at 7 a.m. discovered that a grave had been uncovered in a small cemetery near the western edge of the village. A grave had been uncovered, and the casket had been opened, and the body removed. There were a few beer cans found, and that was about it. Well, immediately, the headlines just raged across the front page of the paper. What happened? Body stealers. Fantastic ghoul at work. And they began to investigate the body to find out if there was an enemy in the past of the woman whose body it had been. And it was a woman. No, the body had been buried there for something like 35 years. It had been a spinster lady with no known relatives. And she had died quietly in her bed, lo, these many years ago. No one knew anything about her at all, except the name and a few vague outlines. Couldn't be any enemies, not striking in the darkness at 3 a.m., 35 years later. And so they began to investigate. There were no leads. The town was on its ear. Everybody was talking about the fantastic grave robbery. About 2 weeks later, on a quiet afternoon, on Wednesday, as a matter of fact, a group of detectives came to the high school. And they split up in the hall. Some went in one direction, some went in another. And 15 minutes later, the Esquire Club was at City Hall. It seems that after one of the meetings in the basement, one of the kids had suggested, why don't we go upstairs, since my mother and father aren't here, and get a couple of cans of beer. In fact, there's a case up there. They went upstairs. 10 minutes later, they are swilling beer and knocking down graham crackers. 15 minutes later, one of them suggests, you know what we ought to have in this club? I'll tell you what we ought to have. We ought to have some kind of a good luck piece. You know, something that stands for the club? I tell you what we ought to have. We ought to have a skull. Well, one thing led to the next. And at 2 a.m., a group of boys took a very elderly Ford out and took off in the direction of the local graveyard. At 2:45 a.m., they were loading into the trunk the body of a lady who had been buried 35 years before. At 3:15 a.m., in the basement of the home where the Esquire Club had held its meeting, in a large wash tub was boiling what was left of the skull of a lady who had been a spinster lady with no known enemies. At 5 a.m., the rest of the body was being deposited far out in the swamps between Gary and Hammond. And the skull lay under one of the boys' beds for over 2.5 weeks while they figured where they could get some radium paint to paint it with. 3 weeks later, it was painted with radium paint, and on the 4th week, it was the star attraction of one of the meetings. 3 days later, the law struck. 3 days later, the law struck. All of the boys, as far as I know, are just normal boys. One of them today is a sign painter. Another one works at the local newspaper. One of the boys was killed in the war. A couple of the boys, as far as I know, have a successful hardware shop in conjunction with one another. I don't think they call it the Esquire Hardware Shop. And they're living along. I doubt whether they say much about it. But somewhere in the background lurks that spectral shadow of Ionesco. There lurks Samuel Beckett. There lurks little old ladies who stand outside of Genet plays and say, oh, well, actually, it's just a story, right, Charles? Just a story. And there lurks Durin Mott. And there lurks the sound of chain-ridden ghosts walking quietly up long marble staircases, dragging behind them the fears and the worries of those who left behind them naught but the dust of desire and dreams. If you've ever read Miss Lonely Hearts, well, out there in the darkness, out there in that arching gothic darkness, it is all there. Every last bit of it is there.
Shrinking Violet is a little girl who
lost Gene Shepherd from the Heinz Collection, September 18th, 1963. We're so out of time. Visit our Facebook page, The Dustbin of History, for more information. We'll be back next week with a very similar program. I'm your curator and janitor, Max Schmid. Thanks for listening, and good morning.
Hi, George. Well, finished with the show. What do you want me to do now?
Did you have a good time in there?
Yeah. Oh, boy, it was fun.
Great. How'd you like to do it every day?
Yeah, yeah. That would be neat. Hey, wait a minute. Do I still get to be the janitor?
Sure.
Oh, okay. It's a deal.